your little patch of earth needs some pep, now is the time to get planting. On our Cincinnati Edition Garden Revival, we're breathing life back into your soil. I'm Lucy May. We're joined by a live studio audience in our new performance space, and our garden experts are here to answer all our audience questions. Joining me now is Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Entomology, Joe Boggs. Hey there, Joe.
And great to be here.
Great to have you. Civic Garden Center Urban Agriculture Coordinator, Kamisha Montgomery. Welcome back, Kamisha.
Thank you, Lucy.
University of Cincinnati Biology Professor Teresa Cully. Thanks for being here, Teresa.
I'm glad to be here.
And Madison Tree Care and Landscaping CEO John Butcher. Welcome back, John.
Hi, everybody.
We won't be taking calls this hour, but we do want to hear from our audience. What are your gardening questions? Flag down one of our volunteers and we'll get you on the air. So when it comes to revivals, something is reemerging this spring, and I'm talking about the cicada comeback. Right, we can have sound effects in the new building.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
That was great.
Yeah. Joe, why are they called Brood 14?
Well, it started back in 1902 because there were scientists that noticed that these things came out at a predictable time. So at first, they just used names for them. You know, they used just regular numbers, but it got very confusing. So a fellow in 1902 came up with this idea that let's just give them Roman numeral names, and they stay with it. So the Brood 14, which we're working with right now, has been called Brood 14 all the way back to 1902. Now, between 1 and 17 are 17-year cicadas. From 18 to 30, those numbers are reserved for cicadas that take 13 years to develop. So that's how that all works out.
Okay. Tell us a little bit more about Brood 14. When is peak cicada season and where are they found?
Well, they're found in 13 states. And I know that we've also experienced Brood 10 in the area, which looks like an X, right? The Roman numeral X. It's also a very large emergence. Just a little side note. Last year, you know, cicadas made national news, but there are actually two broods that emerged. In the southern United States was a 13-year brood, and in Illinois was a 17-year brood. So sometimes they do emerge at the same time. But the brood 14 that we're dealing with now, like I said, is in 13 states. Some areas very heavy, but if you have friends in Virginia and Maryland, they may be seeing them all the way down to northern Alabama, might be seeing them. So a very large brood this year.
We want to hear from our audience. Do you have any questions about cicadas or any other gardening questions? Feel free to raise your hands and get one of our volunteers. Joe, is this brood bigger than Brood 10 that we saw a few years ago?
I think Brood 10 might be a little larger in terms of distribution. In sheer numbers, though, that's hard to predict. And I want to just say this very quickly, if I don't forget it. There's an app that was created by Dr. Gene Kritzky here at Mount St. Joseph University called Cicada Safari. It's free, easy to use. Please go on online to where you can download the app. Take a picture when you see the cicadas. You post it, and that's how we know where these broods are and their size.
Better than Pokemon Go. I think that's what I hear you saying,
that's,
Joe.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, Jen, tell me, what's your name and what's your question?
Hi, my name is Levi, and my question is, why don't cicadas come up more often, and are they harmful to plants?
Wow, that's a fantastic question. So
I'm going to let you answer about the why don't they come back more often, and then I'll ask maybe John about the plants.
There you go.
Okay.
So it just as with yourself, Lee, when you, as you're growing up, you can't grow any faster. It's just every year you just get, you know, taller and older. It's exactly the same thing with cicadas. So it takes 17 years for these to go from, you might say, children to the adult stage, to adults. They can't go any faster, and they can't go any slower. So that's why we have these this very distinct amount of time.
John, what about plants and trees specifically? Can they hurt our trees and plants?
Yes, so they damage trees a little bit by laying their eggs in the underside of the new stems. And what they do is they take the bottom of their I don't know what the
ovipositor.
Ovipositor, yeah. and they dig that into the bottom of the stem, and they create a slit, and they lay the eggs in that, and that's what actually causes the damage, which can cause some of those new stems to fall off later on and die. Maybe not. Sometimes they close over those wounds, but established healthy trees are not going to be harmed overall.
Right.
A tree that's vulnerable or weak or newly planted may run into some problems from that, but most trees that are in the ground and already well established are fine.
Okay, we have another question. What's your name? What's your question?
Hi, my name is Apurba, and my question was, last year when Brood 13 came out, yeah, I had an opportunity of having a chocolate-covered cicada.
Oh, no.
I would like to know the nutritional value of eating cicadas, if you know anything.
I'm totally more interested in the nutritional value of the chocolate, but I do think that's a great question.
Yeah.
Do you know that, Joe?
I would scrape the chocolate off and eat that. Actually, in fairness, and I was joking before we started that I don't like to eat insects, but there are great, they do have great nutritional value. A lot of minerals, as well as very good sources of protein. So in fairness, in a lot of our societies across the world, you know, insects are a very important part of the diet.
Kamisha, what are you all doing about your Civic Garden Center, or can they be harmful for vegetable gardens?
Well, we haven't noticed any at the Civic Garden Center in our vegetable garden on the grounds, but as far as cicadas being harmful to edible plants, they don't really feed on the vegetation. So the most that you will find some issues with, like John already explained, is younger fruit trees. So covering those will be best as far as like insect netting or tool, you know, from a big box store, or you can just grab your old veil and put that over your tree. And you also want to be particular cautious with your blueberry bushes and things like that, because especially if they're pretty young, because they, like John already said, they make the slits and deposit the eggs. So it's very important for you to just be visual about that and prune to make sure that you're eradicating your garden of the cicada eggs.
Okay. Well, Teresa, something else making a comeback, ticks. Yeah. Are ticks on the rise?
Yeah, ticks unfortunately are on the rise. So as a plant biologist, I'm oftentimes out in the field, and I do not like things that suck my blood or attach to me. I don't know about you. So we are seeing an increase in ticks, and Josh Benoit at my department in UC, he studies this. And so there's different reasons why we're seeing ticks increase. One is just that things are getting warmer. It doesn't get as cold in the winter, so the ticks can overwinter and they don't die off. And so they just keep growing, you know, like Joe was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one big reason. The other, well, there's actually two more. One is just in urbanized environments. We just have a lot of people around. Mm-hmm. And we also end up having a lot of deer. So ticks like deer. So oftentimes when you see increased deer in a warmer type of area, you start to see more ticks.
Okay. We have another question in the audience. What's your name? What's your question?
Hi, my name is Jackson. And my question is, are ticks beneficial to the environment in any way?
That's a great question, because can't we just kill them all, Joe?
You know, that is, we get that question about cicadas and a lot of these insects. Of course, ticks aren't insects, but yes, we always have to look at it from the ecology. Ticks are eaten by things.
Mm.
So they are very important food. And it's one reason why, you know, some of these problematic arthropods like ticks and some of the insects, we see populations rise and fall dramatically, because they are serving as food for things. Everything from predacious insects to different diseases that will affect arthropods. So that's how we have to view ticks and things we may not like. The squirmies out there actually are serving an ecological purpose.
Okay. Harper, we have another question.
Hi, my name is Jacob Groh, and my question is, why do ticks like our blood?
Yeah, Joe, why do ticks like our blood?
I was looking at Teresa over there. She's a biologist.
Okay, Teresa, what about your blood? Do they like your blood especially? Are you extra sweet?
I'm thinking more of mosquitoes love my blood.
Oh.
But, Joe, I don't know. I mean, with ticks, I'm trying to think if certain people are susceptible. I do know that ticks and other critters tend to sort of angle themselves on the edge of vegetation waiting for someone to walk by.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the blood is just simply what they eat. It's it's how they get their nutritional value. And they've simply evolved that way to be able to be little vampires. But once again, there's sometimes we say like two, it's just they have no choice. They just woke up one day, they've been bitten by another tick, and they turned into... No, wait, that's a different story.
It's like me with chocolate chip cookies. I have no choice. This is what I like to eat. Harper, we have another question. What's your name and what's your question?
Hi, my name is Lydia. My question is, what's an eco-friendly and kid-friendly way to get rid of pests like ticks and mosquitoes without harming the beneficial pollinators and helpful garden insects?
Want me to do that?
Yeah, why don't you do it and I'll follow up.
Well, this is an excellent question. You know, years and years ago, and a lot of people may not realize this, but turf grass was actually started in being used in Europe and elsewhere to drive pests away from homes. Because, you know, originally we had all these plants right up to your house. And, of course, now we're seeing, and I love it, I love seeing pollinator gardens right next to the home. I love to see naturalized areas. We all do. However, if we have those right up against the house, as Teresa just said, ticks really do well. If it's moist, they don't do well where it's dry. They actually do fairly well with high temperatures, but if you put them hot and dry, they will not make it. So a good environmentally friendly way, rather than spraying, is just simply to try to get your vegetation away from the home a bit. And then if you're using turf grass for that purpose, keep it mowed, because that's also another harbinger of ticks and also chiggers and some other things we don't like.
Anything you want to add, Teresa?
Yeah, I was just going to sort of, emphasize what you were saying about just making sure not to spray, because if you spray for a lot of ticks and chiggers and mosquitoes and things like that, you just have to think about the fact that other insects that are beneficial could be negatively impacted by that. Mm-hmm. So, native bees, butterflies and so forth. John?
I just wanted to add in like really simple stuff, like if you have a garbage can lid that's full of water, that's more of a mosquito than it is a tick. But also, I guess this is a question follow-up, if we improve drainage in our yards, would that be an eco-friendly way to mitigate ticks?
Yeah. And other bad things.
And other bad things.
Yes. Also, in an edible garden, planting herbs like lavender, mint, marigolds, things of that nature can also help with sort of decreasing the tick population around your garden.
Oh, nice. That stuff smells good, too. Jen, what's your name and what's your question?
Hi. My name is Joan, and my question is that I have some flower beds that I want to expand where there's lawn, and I want to know, I've heard that you can put cardboard on the lawn and then put something on top of the cardboard. Is that a good way to do it? I don't know what if it really works.
Yeah, who wants to take that one?
It's interesting. I just realized with a live audience, people listening can't see us shaking our heads up and down. We were all doing it. We were all saying, that could work.
Yeah,
anything like that. Cardboard, black plastic might be better. It just goes faster. You trap a lot more heat. Temperature rises, it can kill deeper. The cardboard is primarily killing the grass just simply by shading. It takes longer. So I think I'd probably use like a black plastic, just lay rocks on it, keep it down. That works fairly well. And that's also a pretty good way to get rid of weeds that are very stubborn if you don't want to use an herbicide.
Teresa, that blast kind of be like a garbage bag?
I was going to say, it is going to take time. So cardboard does work, but it will take weeks probably. For me, I just grunt and just get a shovel and dig it out if I can.
That is a good point. Yeah. Make little toupees. Not that I know anything about it.
Only for you, Joe.
Okay. Well, let's turn to another pest that can be misunderstood, chiggers. Teresa, what can we possibly be misunderstanding about chiggers? Aren't they just our sworn enemies? I mean, is there other stuff to know?
Well, there's things that I don't really like about them. I tend to get them, again, in high weeds, wet areas. And so when I first got them, people would tell me, oh, it's the little insect and it goes down your hair follicle and it's sitting there for days and days feeding, you know, on you. And I told you before, I hate things feeding on me. That's actually not really true. So what they do is it's usually the larva, they'll latch on, they'll find some soft area of your skin, and they do go down the hair follicle oftentimes, and they'll put their spit on your skin. And it actually causes your cells to liquefy. It's like a horror film. And then they have a little straw, essentially. And Joe can back me up on this, maybe.
Yes, true. It's
and they
movie.
Suck up the liquefied cells of your body. And then they get their meal and they fall off. And so they're gone. So what happens is our body have a reaction to
yeah,
the
it
spit.
Does.
And so it causes you to itch. And so that's the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Chigger spit. That's
chigger
yes,
spit.
Now you know.
Anybody in the audience had a run-in with chiggers? Any chigger questions out there? Okay. We've got one right here. Jen, if you want to get, you do not have a chigger question? Okay. Here. Well, we're going to keep moving until we get to that chigger question. Joe, why are chiggers bright red? Is it just to advertise their evil?
Yeah. I like that. Yeah. Chiggers are a type of mite, and they're not red throughout their development. But it's you know, simply sometimes when these colors are used, they're used so that others of the species can find one another. And so I'm speculating that might be what's going on. But one thing we didn't touch on is how do we avoid chiggers?
That's a great idea. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, because we're you know, chiggers do not spread diseases that we're aware of. But of course, our disease-causing agents, but ticks do. And so we need to be very mindful of that these days. And it seems to be getting a lot worse. I don't know if we're identifying more diseases, or I think probably there are more pathogens being spread as we see more different species of ticks. So you have a couple of options. You know, one is obviously, as we just said, to avoid tick areas. And that's pretty important. If you wander off the path very far, remember what we already said. Ticks like to have, you know, brush. They like to have plant material that's very thick. If you do have to, though, go off the trail, then you really need to seriously consider a repellent. Now, one of the favorites out there is DEET, D-E-E-T. That's diethylmethyl toluamide. But some people are a bit sensitive to that. I am, for example, I can't get it on my skin. I get a little goofier than I normally am.
You seem laughing. Sensitive, Joe. Yeah.
As a replacement, I actually use pants that are treated with an insecticide called permethrin. Our U.S. military uses this. It's very effective. You want to, anytime you're using anything like this, read and follow those label directions very, very closely. But the tick-treated clothing works extremely well. I've been in some very heavy tick-infested areas helping to do tick counts, and it works very well. But don't just pretend that you can go in and come out and wash them off. I think that's puts us at a high-risk area. So unfortunately, it's going to have to be a deterrent either very directly or something that keeps them off, like the permethrin.
We have one question before we break. Go ahead.
Actually, I have two questions.
Okay. And what's your name?
My name is Kate, and I'm from East Walnut Hills. My first question is diatomaceous earth helpful for, you know, keeping chiggers away? And then my second question is it true that ticks can, like, see you from afar? Like, I heard that they can, like, sense heat, like they kind of like have heat vision in that way. And when they do, like, do they jump on you? Because every time I'm walking my dog in woods, like, that's all I'm thinking about is that they can, like, see me.
Yeah, that's creepy. Okay, I'm gonna ask you, Kamisha, about the diatomaceous earth. I feel like we talk to you about diatomaceous earth all the time.
Yeah, definitely. I think it is helpful. It is something that I think, you know, it wouldn't hurt to use it. Also, as far as like in vegetable gardens, like Jill said, removing debris is very useful, and also pruning like your tomato plants and making sure you're providing a lot more sunlight to those areas where they might, you know, be down near in your garden. So I think those are some good ways to do as far as in a vegetable garden. But I do think the diatomaceous earth would be useful.
Joe, do ticks have heat vision?
I like that. And then, Katie, I really like the idea of them just leaping out. You know,
yeah.
Actually, Teresa just described it perfectly when you did that thing. That's exactly right. So what they like to do, it's a shame, you know, that the listeners can't see all of our expressions. But what they do is they will climb to an area, you know, let's say a stem of grass, a very tall grass, and they hold on with their hind legs, and then they'll have their front legs out. Now, they don't really have great vision. We know that. But there is a bit of a heat sensory organ. And as you walk by, they just know, you know, there's a grasping. And if you look closely, I know this is where things get a little bit. If you really do, as you're walking along and looking, it's kind of fun if you do find one and put your hand next to it. entomologists, we come up with interesting ways to entertain ourselves. But if you put your hand next to it, you will see it starting to kind of, you know, just, food. Yeah.
No, thank you. Okay. Well, let's circle back to cicadas because that's the subject of our first trivia question. Our bug expert entomologist Joe Boggs has the question.
Trivia question.
Yes, about cicadas.
I'm sorry.
Do you recall this conversation?
I do recall it. thinking back. So, trivia question. How long do cicadas live?
Okay. How long do cicadas live? Think of your answers. No cheating with your phones. We'll take some responses after our first break. We've been giving bugs a hard time, so later in the program, we're going to talk about the benefits of insects. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. I'm Lucy May. We're joined by a live studio audience and our expert gardeners, Kamisha Montgomery, Teresa Cully, John Butcher, and Joe Boggs. We're reviving your garden today, and that includes making a good habitat for wildlife in your yard. But first, does anybody in our audience have an answer for trivia? Harper, is that what you're... Okay, go ahead. Tell us your name and tell us your answer.
My name is Drew, and I got 17 years.
Okay, Drew, what say you, Joe Boggs?
Outstanding. Outstanding.
Okay. And again, the question was, I should have had you repeat the question, the cicada lifespan is what we were looking for? And
17, or also someone, I think, could have said 13, mm-hmm. because they're both. They're 17 and 13. And what's the longest lived insect? Now, this is kind of interesting. Some termite queens can live over 50 years. Lose their mandibles, you know.
Yeah.
just kind of gum their...
I don't... Poor anyway, termite sorry, queens. Yeah. We're giving them a hard time. I'm feeling that myself these days. Okay, well, let's talk... Great job. Thank you for that answer. Yeah. Let's talk about gardening for wildlife. Kamisha, how can you provide a water source for wildlife or even a nesting site for birds?
Well, just encouraging them to come to the garden by... providing a water source is also always beneficial. You can use bird feeders, just making sure that it's not very deep, just making sure that it's shallow. You can put small stones or small branches or twigs inside so they can sort of just lean over and grab a sip of water. You can also do that to encourage bees. There's also something called a bee cup that you can put into your gardens with long stems or short stems, mm-hmm. That can also just give bees a nice sip of water. But, you know, those are some ways that you can try to encourage wildlife to stay hydrated in the garden, besides planting pollinators and things of that nature to encourage them to come to your garden to pollinate.
Yeah. And Joe, we gave bugs a real hard time in our last discussion. I know I'm guilty of that. But how are insects beneficial? They're many of them are our friends, right?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, many of the pollinators that we try to attract, many of them are enemies of other insects. So here's a good example. If you have tomatoes this year and you see their little tomato hornworms on there with these white things sprouting, those are actually parasitoid wasp cocoons. From each one of those cocoons will emerge a female wasp, and she will go off and then lay eggs on another caterpillar. But in between, she has to have nectar. So every parasitoid wasp has to have nectar. So when we plant our pollinator gardens, we're not only helping the bees and beneficials that way, but we're also helping to reduce pests so we can reduce dependence on insecticides.
Do we have another question from the audience? What is your name and what's your question?
My name's Joe. Every year we plant something we haven't done before. This year we planted some loofah seeds. So they're now, they germinated. I planted them outside in a raised bed. They're in full sun. They look fine, but they're only like 2 inches high with green leaves, and they're not growing. Is it they're just not getting enough sun?
Kamesha is the expert.
Unfortunately, I have not been successful with growing loofahs. Now, I've grown loofahs to the point where the foliage was just taking over, but I wasn't successful as actually growing the loofah itself. But I would suggest, you know, at that stage, just adding some compost, some kind of nitrogen fertilizers. No reason to add any P or K at this time because you said they were about 6 inches.
Two inches,
yeah. Yeah, definitely just adding some, I think compost will be beneficial.
I've been told they have a really long growing season. Is that true?
That is true.
Yeah. So maybe I just waited too long.
Yeah, maybe a little more patience. I don't know. I'm not saying you're impatient. I would never say that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Teresa, anything you wanted to add about that?
Yeah, I just want to say a few things. One is for the bees, getting back to that. I've gotten to bees lately. And it's really important to keep in mind that there's a lot of native bees. In fact, I think there's like 500 different species in Ohio.
Yeah.
And so these are not the normal honeybees we think about. Those are not native to Ohio. Mm-hmm. And of course, we need them now to do some pollination because we don't have enough native bees. And this is why I always advocate people put up those little bee boxes that you can get. And a lot of our native bees are stingless, so they don't hurt, they don't sting you, they're beautiful, and a lot of them are solitary, so that's important.
And just a reminder, we can take questions about anything. It doesn't have to be about bugs. It can be general gardening questions, like that last terrific question we just had from Joe, and we have another question.
Hi, my name is Reese, and my question is, what is the hardest challenge you faced as a gardener?
As a garden what? Gardener. Okay, I'm going to, let's see, Kamesha, I'm going to throw that to you first. What's your biggest challenge? You're like a super gardener, so I don't know if you have challenges.
Well, there it is. There's the answer. Staying within the lines. My hardest challenge, I think, was my initial start to growing food was I learned about a specific method, and as soon as that season was over, that method was out of the window, you know, because I saw just so many different opportunities to grow things, like to do different techniques like intercropping. There's a lot more space that was available that I just didn't take advantage of. So I think that was one of my biggest, I would say, learning opportunities. And my next year, I just did a lot more different techniques and did a lot more aggressive growing. But also that takes a lot more time, and it also takes a lot more effort to manage that to be successful.
Harper, did you say there's another question here?
Hi, I'm Cindy, and my question is, I live in a condo where there are a lot of deer that come and munch on everything we plant in the common areas. So can you recommend anything that they won't find tasty?
Oh, Kamesha, do you have any?
I certainly have ideas.
Oh, please, John.
Yes, John. Help us out.
Well, I don't recommend this, but boxwoods are for sure tried and true.
Oh, my gosh, John. I can't believe you said boxwoods during this show.
Some of the other things I really like, and this is more particular for shade, but Lenten Rose do a really good job. Ferns are really good. Brunera is another one that I really like. That's a perennial. There's a bunch of other shrubs I'll think about along the way, and we can talk after the show maybe, and I'll come up with a few more. But there's almost everything that I plant that I think is deer resistant. I find out somewhere it's not, and there's very few things that are 100% haven't seen them eat anywhere.
Hmm. Okay.
I love the boxwoods. Thank you.
Right. I had to.
I thought we were going to get past the show without talking about boxwoods, but it didn't happen. John, what about dandelions? Where do you stand on dandelions? A lot of people try to get rid of them. What if your kids are blowing on the little white guys like crazy? Is that something that should alarm us?
Well, I think it's all about preference and culture and what you want to do with your world. Most people who I work with and for treat their lawns and they kind of eradicate the dandelions. I am a fan of the flowers in the lawn. And
tell us more. Why? Why are you pro-dandelion?
Well, it's not just dandelions. It's all of the flowers and the other things that are going on the lawn that attract the insects and the bees. And then we're putting down less chemicals in the world to just spread over the earth and have more green grass. And in my opinion, if you can mow it and it's green and the kids can play on it and it's a smooth surface, it's a win. And when I see a perfectly green lawn with no weeds in it, I'm less inclined to want to go play in it than I am when I see the flowers and stuff in it.
Because of the, you figure there are chemicals in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think, Kamisha? How do you stand on the great dandelion debate, pro or con?
Well, there's pros and cons, like John described. But as far as from a edible garden aspect, they are edible. The entire plant is edible. It's full of antioxidants and vitamins. So I think, you know, that's one of the biggest pros. You know, you can eat the foliage, the leaves in salads. So, you know, there's a lot of different pros. It's also, you know, has very deep roots. So trying to eradicate them, you know, will take a lot more effort than just simply taking out the stem. It's just making sure that you getting to those roots. But because they have such a big root structure or deep root structure, they're also good for aerating your soil. So there are some pros and some cons to having dandelions.
Okay. We have another question. What's your name and what's your question?
Hi, my name is Bonnie, and I was wondering, how do we deal with box tree moths and other invasive species without harming plant life or non-invasive species?
Well, coming back to the boxwoods, Joe.
I love it. You know, seriously, it's boxwoods are one of the oldest landscape plants that we've been using in North America. The record's going well back into the 1600s. But this question, part of the answer, I'm going to go over to Teresa on this, because one thing about any type of pest is that if we look hard enough, we will find there are some hosts that they will not touch. So box tree moth, for example, is native to Asia, a very large area of Asia, and we have Asian boxwoods. So it would stand to reason they don't really do much harm to Asian boxwoods. And if we then can work with the genetics of boxwoods to be able to have boxwoods with those genetics in there, and I'm just going to stop and turn it over to Teresa because that's exactly what she is doing right now.
Ooh, Teresa.
So one of the things is, if you know Joe, he pulls you into a lot of different projects. Mm-hmm. So he pulled me into a boxwood project, trying to find a type of boxwood that is resistant, naturally resistant to box tree moth, as well as any of these other little things that hit the boxwoods. And so that's what we're working on, using genetics and looking largely, like you said, at the Asian species. Mm-hmm. But the other thing to remember, some of you, do you all know what boxwood is? Okay, we see some yeses and some noes.
Yeah. Go ahead.
If it's a no, so oftentimes these are plants that are planted along the base of the foundation of houses. Mm-hmm. Or if you think about the large English mazes in the English countryside or Mount Vernon with the greenery all over, those are usually boxwoods. So that's what we're talking about. And I do understand, Joe, you might know more about this. You can treat it effectively if you choose to do so.
You can, and we always like to look at insecticides as the last resort. That's just a good way of viewing it. But I really like the second part of the question on all non-native invasives. How do we go about managing them with reduced environmental impact? And I have to say, you know, we can, for example, now plant American elms after they almost got wiped out by a non-native pathogen spread by a couple non-native beetles. So that's the great hope, is always looking at host preference so that we have resistance and we don't need to do anything insecticide-wise. John?
Well, I wanted to throw in what I think is maybe the most important part about all of this is monoculture, which is where we plant the same thing over and over and over again. Yeah. So the big problem with boxwoods specifically is that we planted just billions of them all over, mm-hmm. and there's so many, and it's got the exact same genetic makeup. Well, there's 10 really popular types that are grown and grown over and over and over again. And when you do that, you create a real susceptibility to a disease, and we talk about Dutch elm and other mm-hmm. things. It's all the same problem, is that we just planted too much of the same thing over and over again. So what I would encourage is not to... You can use boxwoods, but there's lots of other things to use too, instead of just planting the same thing every time.
Diversity is what it's about.
Yep. Yeah. We have another question. What's your name and what's your question?
Hi, my name is John. I have a question and maybe a comment. The question is, I'm trying to add a native pollinator garden to my backyard, but I'm finding a lot of issues, whether it's a cultivar or a nativar. What do you recommend planting so it can be native without causing issue to the animals and the bugs that are going to be feeding on it?
Okay, I'll ask for kind of a quick response because we have to take a break in just a minute or so.
But it'd have to be Teresa if you want a quick yeah. response.
So I'll say real quickly, this is a hot topic. Yeah. The nativars is what we call that. People have different opinions. My personal opinion is I always like native species whatsoever, if you can get them in there. And so if it's a nativar, in other words, a native cultivar, I think that's better than not having it there. So I'm sort of a proponent of that. The problem with nativars is that if it's the same genetic individual cloned all over the place, then we get back to the problem that John was talking about, where you have a monoculture. So that's why you would really, in some cases, want to have a variety of different plants of a certain native species. So I'm going back and forth. I don't know if that answered your question.
Did you want to make a quick comment?
Yeah, if you don't mind. Joe, you mentioned loofahs. They like hot weather, and that's when they'll start growing out of that little short phase.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's great. We love it when our audience has great advice for other people who are listening. Let's go to our next trivia question real quick. This time it's about ginkgo trees. We turn now to our resident arborist, John Butcher, for this question.
What type of ginkgo trees are smelly?
That's the question. What type of ginkgo trees are smelly? We're going to continue our gardening show after a short break. If you think you have the answer, let us know. This is Cincinnati Edition.
Support comes from listeners like you and from...
This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're in the final stretch of our May Garden Revival. We have a live studio audience, and we're joined by our esteemed garden experts, John Butcher, Joe Boggs, Teresa Cully, and Kamisha Montgomery. Let's get to trivia. John, remind us of the question.
What type of ginkgo trees are smelly?
Okay, and we have an answer.
Rita, it's the female.
Rita, I'm so glad a woman answered that.
Yes.
What say you, John? Tell us about smelly stinko ginkgos.
Well, that's correct. And the problem is, to give a little more info, is that when you plant a ginkgo tree, they don't start reproducing right away. And so oftentimes the tree will be 10 or 15 years old or older before it starts to produce fruit. So if you collect a ginkgo from seed and plant it, and grow it, you really don't know what you have for a long time. So if you're selecting a ginkgo to plant in your yard and you don't want the fruit, you want to make sure to get a male cultivar of that.
And you can, they're good about that? Because when you buy a gerbil, they might tell you it's a boy gerbil. Well, and it could be a lady gerbil.
I think you want to go to a reputable nursery.
Okay.
And they'll have it labeled as there's an Autumn Gold or a Princeton Century. There's a couple more, but those are the two most popular ones.
Okay. Well, one ginkgo tree had a long life outside the new school Montessori, providing golden leaves for the children to play with, but the old tree had to be cut down last year. Now the school has new ginkgo trees to keep the tradition of their original tree alive. And of course, one way to pass on the legacy of a plant is through propagation. Taking a cutting of a tree or other plant can create a whole new plant. John, how does propagation work with trees?
Well, there's lots of ways to propagate trees. picking up seeds and growing seeds is a way to propagate. And actually, that's a way when we talk about the nativar thing, if we're actually collecting seeds, we're taking the cultivar part out of that by having a sexually reproduced organism with genes coming in from different places. That solves a lot of the problems. So seeds are a really good way to do it. But most of our trees that are sold in nurseries are produced by grafting. And that's typically done over on the west coast, northwest coast of the U.S., Oregon area. And they're taking a seedling, and they're taking a bud or a really small piece of the mother plant that we call it, which is the red sunset maple or the autumn gold ginkgo. And they slip that bud into the stem of the seedling. And once the mother plant part takes off and starts to grow, they'll cut the original seedling off, and then the new plant grows, which is a cloned organism essentially, but that's how most trees are grown in Ohio. And then they're grown out in Oregon for a few years, depending on how big they are. All the soil is shaken off of them, they're packed into a semi and shipped all over the country.
Oh, fascinating. Harper, you have someone with a question. What's your name and what's your question?
Hi, my name is Sue, and I planted Northern Sea Oats, beautiful grass, recently, last year, and it's really, I've noticed this this year, it's going all over the place, quite invasively. Do you have some recommendations on how to keep it in control? Because I really like the beautiful plumes that it produces at the end of season.
I don't think that it'll handle a mowing regimen from the places that I've seen it managed, where if you have a lawn area and you mow the lawn, you don't see it take off in the lawn. So if you were to put those other areas of sea oats on that same regimen and mow weekly and just keep it beat down, it's not going to be able to sustain and take off in those areas. That would be a way to do it without herbicides. Certainly you could use a variety of herbicides to control it too, which could be organic or traditional.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Susan, and I'm a welder. I make garden stakes and garden trellises. Wow. I'd like to know if there's anything that I should consider with plants growing up around metal and painted metal.
Oh, great question. What about edible plants, Kimmy? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, especially for like wood, I would make sure or try to see if it's treated or not. A lot of times we are given wood that we don't know, you know, from old barns or something like that, that I would try to look out for different stamps and things like that to see if it has been treated.
And this other is for the metal that she's using?
Well, no, just for wood. For wood, but as far as for like metal, I would think about more if it's painted or something like that. That can be cause for, you know, alarm. But it could be, you know, something that's pretty faint and won't really leach into the soil as much. So, you know, that's something that I think is more of like a preference, especially if it's an edible garden.
Teresa, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I was just going to say that if you're trying to repurpose some old metal, say an old, I don't know, metal bed frame or something, you'd want to make sure it doesn't have lead paint. You know, so those are some of the basics. But it sounds like you might be talking about your own creation and some new metal. And I can't think of any problem with that.
Well, and you often see vines on wrought iron. Now, I know that's hard to weld, but there's really no problem with the metal itself. I'm not a metallurgist, but you're just exactly right, though. When we start painting metals, which you're not, you do have to be a little careful about what's in that paint. Yeah.
Sometimes we want to share a plant with family and friends. Maybe it's been in our family for years, like our own Marshall Verbsky's grapevines. Look at how cute it is. How does propagation help us do that?
Well, as far as like with the grapevine, you can use the technique of grafting to try to help it, I guess, survive in this region. Since I believe you said that it was from your family in Italy.
Yeah, wow. I think wasn't quite Italy. It was, tell us, Marshall.
It was just south of Prague what is now the Czech Republic.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you brought that here, it might be susceptible to different pests. So just, I think grafting will be a great way to try to prevent some of those soil-borne issues. But also as far as trying to, like, say, for instance, you wanted to keep something close to your heart or in your family, like heirloom tomatoes or something like that. That'll be a great way to sort of save those seeds and pass along. But grafting that also onto another tomato plant is also beneficial, because a lot of rare and heirloom crops are susceptible to pest issues and disease. So you can get something that is disease resistant and grafted onto that. So that's a great way as far as propagating and continuing to share those with family and friends.
Okay. Let's take another question real quick. What's your name? What's your question?
Yes, my name is Jessica, and I don't use any pesticides in my yard, but I do have water gardens, little big pots with lilies and so forth. And in the heat of the summer, they're really popular with all the birds and the bees. But I got a little concerned last year when it started to be the hangout for all the neighborhood cats. And I do use mosquito dunks, and I wondered if there's any sort of alternative to that, or if that is safe to use for plants and animals.
Anybody have thoughts on that?
Mosquito what? I didn't hear.
Did you say mosquito nets?
Mosquito dunks.
Oh, no, mosquito.
Oh, yeah, dunks.
Mosquito,
oh, yeah. I see.
That's Bacillus thuringiensis, and the variant is Israeliensis, and it's very, very specific to Diptera, would be mosquitoes and so forth. So the beauty of that is that birds, other animals, it's not going to touch. I do want to just say something about bringing plants in, though, from outside of the U.S., kind of back to the grape thing. You know, first of all, Europe has long fought grape phylloxera. That's a native North American insect that ravaged the European grapes. So if you happen to have a grape in Europe that has not been grafted on American stock and you brought it over here, it could likely be killed by grape phylloxera. A lot of people don't realize this, but the U.S. really played a big role in saving the wine industry in Europe. But even beyond that, be very careful bringing any plants into the United States for fear of bringing in non-natives.
Yeah, good point. Marshall didn't do that. This was great-grandparents or something. So he's an innocent victim of all this. We have one more. We can take one more question real quickly. We're almost running out of time.
Hi, my name's Courtney. I live in Bellevue across the river. My question is about hanging baskets. So last year I had Boston ferns on my front porch. My porch faces the southeast, gets a lot of sun. They look great. I like the aesthetic, but I couldn't keep them alive, and they just fried out there, even with me watering them every other day deeply.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm gonna cut you off. We have 10 seconds for an answer. I'm looking at you, Teresa.
I kill them too, so I'm not gonna help.
Oh, wow.
It needs to be on the north side.
The great thing is you are in the audience. You can talk to our experts afterwards, get a better answer for your question. No offense. It's been so great speaking with all of you during our Cincinnati Edition Garden Revival. Big thanks to Kamisha Montgomery with the Civic Garden Center, Teresa Cully with the University of Cincinnati, John Butcher with Madison Tree Care, and Joe Boggs with The Ohio State University. Special thanks to our volunteers at WVXU and to our studio audience. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical directors are Marshall Verbsky and Carlos Lopez-Cornu. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.